The LA Times asked Jim Cramer, "Given the sheer number of stocks you suggest, either buying or selling in any given show, do you worry that you're encouraging people to trade in and out, even though all the research says the vast majority of investors won't make money as active traders?" And Jim replied, "Let's just say I struggle with it. In year one of the show, I was much more oriented towards stock of the day, and I didn't like that. In year two, I went away from that. In year three, this year, I'm trying to say, listen, there are broader themes. There are broader sectors. You can try to pick the best of breed in the sector. I go back to the fundamental idea that stocks can be interesting, and therefore, if you're interested, you'll be better off than if you just let the broker handle you. You'll be a better client and a better investor." Then the LA Times asked, "But you agree that very few people can make a lot of money actively trading?" And Cramer replied, "It's a sucker's game. Mad Money Machine." Show 78. Second week of September. Hello, everybody. This is Paul Douglas Boyer. Welcome back to the Mad Money Machine. I'm glad to have you with me once again. I appreciate you sticking with me all these many weeks and months and coming up on a couple of years now. On this show, we're going to have a spin a guru roulette. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the formula for happiness. I'm going to talk some more about the tax loss tango. And, of course, sucker. All that and a whole lot more coming up on the Mad Money Machine. Proud to be sponsored by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com. On the previous show, I mentioned the tax loss tango, where if you're invested in a taxable account, it might be a good idea to have two of each kind of fund or asset allocation that you want to be invested in. That way, when you put money in it, if it goes down, you can sell it and put it in the other one. And I even went as far as to say you could buy, say, the Vanguard S&P 500 fund, sell it and put it in the iShares S&P 500 fund. Well, some people commented in the show notes and through email saying, "Hey, wait a minute, that's my substantially identical type of investment, and the IRS wouldn't allow that." Ah, but if you look at some of the other articles that there are out there, and I have some in the show notes for this show, as well as in the comments of the previous show, I have some links to articles that suggest it might not be impossible to be able to exchange two S&P 500 index funds, one for the other. Well, in any case, that's a more rare event than what I'm talking about, because if you have a small cap ETF, for example, one small cap ETF is probably going to be substantially different from the other small cap ETF or index fund. And so, once again, I don't pretend to be an IRS lawyer, and I would dread the day that someone made me do that anyway. But consult your tax advisor, but do consider the tax loss tango as a strategy for saving yourself some money. Let's turn our attention now towards soccer. I read a fantastic book recently that, basically good books are those that confirm your previously preconceived notions. Right? The ones that confirm what you already believe. Well, in this case, it was a book called Soccerhead, written by Jim Hayner. And let me just read the review from Publishers Weekly. It says, "The year his son turned six, Hayner was shanghaied by a group of local parents into coaching the College Park Hornets, a scrappy group of boys and one girl, finding their legs on the peewee soccer fields outside Washington, D.C. His book charts the ensuing his ensuing obsession with the sport in a language as brisk as the game. Between weekly matches, Hayner, a Baltimore Sun writer, pores over books, visits fabled soccer homelands, and interviews legends to uncover the American heart of this foreign game. Although Native Americans played a version of soccer with a deerskin ball, the sport really took root in the U.S. in the 1930s when immigrant workers played in raucous leagues. Walter Barr, who took the winning shot against the English in a 1950 World Cup game, tells Hayner how his team of blue-collar laborers stunned some of the world's best players. But Hayner learns the essence of the sport from his kids. Watching them play, he sees how fluidity, creativity, and trust reign in this simple game. After the Hornets lose a county championship, Hayner concludes, "There is a God, and he gave us soccer at the dawn of time so that we would never forget who's in charge." I really enjoyed this book. One of the things that I found in the book is that in fact, soccer is popular now, more popular than baseball for children, and it's not hard to see why. One of the key reasons why is that girls don't play baseball for the most part, whereas a large contingent of girls play soccer, and the immediate doubling of the population in the sport has made it so much more popular. And the other thing is, soccer actually brings in money to many of the county leagues, whereas the other sports, not so much. Soccer, with all the tournaments that they can host and things, brings in sometimes millions of dollars into a local population with the hotels and travel and all of the, say, 500 teams coming into town for an event. He explains in the book how the turning point, the tipping point, if you will, and he actually refers to it that way, was the 1991 World Cup win of the United States women's national team, and how that really energized not only soccer, but particularly girls' soccer in the United States. And so for me, it helped explain why I'd never heard about soccer when I was growing up. Of course, I saw Pele on the Wide World of Sports or something, but that was the extent of my soccer knowledge. And really, until recently, I mean, 2 or 3 years ago, I didn't know the rules of soccer. Absolutely befuddled watching it, just as I'm still befuddled by watching lacrosse. Well, speaking of the obsession, I did wake up at 4:30 this morning, turned into ESPN2 to watch the start of the women's soccer team, the women's national team, play against North Korea in China for the Women's World Cup of Soccer. It was a great, great game. Abby Wambach got kind of bloodied up there for a while, had to be taken out of the game for about 8 minutes to get stitched up, and North Koreans scored 2 goals against the United States during those 8 minutes, so she's apparently a pretty important member of the team. U.S. came back to tie it 2-2, and I guess good news for the United States is that Sweden tied Nigeria in the other Group B matches, so everybody's tied, everybody's got 1 point in Group B as of today.
It's hard to survive all living in the world. Rain is falling, falling a long time. Yeah. It's hard to survive all living in the world. Rain is falling, falling a long time. It's hard to survive.
You remember how I've talked about working on the mathematical formula for happiness. Well, before you create anything new on your own, you have to do research to see what's already been invented, of course. And, of course, that means Googling mathematical formula for happiness. And, of course, I found an article in the Washington Post.
I feel like a loser.
June 25th, 2006, just last year, entitled Happy? The surprisingly simple factors that add up to feeling good. The article says, got your pencil sharpened? Voila, happiness equals S plus C plus V. Huh? Let us explain. In the equation, S is your biological disposition toward being happy, also known as your happiness set point. C represents the conditions in which you live, some of which are fixed, like your age or your sex, and some of which you can change, like the relationships you establish. Finally, V stands for the voluntary activities that you engage in: work, vacations, meditation, exercise, even playing with warm puppies. Regarding the happiness set point, they say studies of twins indicate that the rose-colored glasses we associate with happy people may be as genetically determined as the reading glasses donned by farsighted folks. Some people, it seems, are just born happier than others. Are you a glasses half full or glass half empty type? Or a glass is twice as big as it needs to be type? And so what happens if you're stuck with a low happiness set point? Big bummer, right? Well, yes and no. They advise that you think of the biological happiness as a temperature range rather than a fixed point, just like a thermostat, and the life choices we make can push our happiness levels to the upper threshold of our individual set point. That's where the C and the V of the equation come into play. C are the conditions for happiness. They say studies indicate that other people really do make us happy. Good people bring out the best in us. They say national wealth matters, but on a personal level, making very big money doesn't really make the individual person very happy. Investing in good social relationships is a safer bet. They estimate that a person's social-emotional relationships account for between 15 and 20% of your happiness level, and that married people are more satisfied with their lives than singles. Americans move too much, change jobs too much, change partners too much, says Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T. Life is not a competition to see who can produce the most stuff. Indeed, in the scramble of modern American life, we seem to ignore the fact that though individuals in the industrialized world have gotten richer and richer over the past 50 years, our happiness levels have remained steady and incidences of depression have actually increased. So how do we regain our connection? It's simple, really. Treat other people as if they were the key to your happiness. Science tells us that they are. Of course, how we treat people and how we interact with them, from eating with your family to introducing yourself to the new neighbors, is all a matter of choice, which leads us to the V, the final part of the equation, which is the voluntary nature of happiness. V is really about the everyday things we do to create happiness. Anyone who has slogged through a dead-end job, counting the hours until quitting time, already knows that the right job is a big part of day-to-day happiness. But finding good, meaningful work, to what Jonathan Haidt refers to as a calling, is easier said than done. That's why they call it work. People often think, I'll be happy when, says Pete Cohen, a life coach and co-author of Feeling Good for No Good Reason. But when we get whatever it is we're chasing, a raise, a promotion, a good solid kick of the pigskin, it turns out we never really find joie de vivre. The key is to tap into the total immersion of what happens when people are so involved in an activity that nothing else seems to matter. Instead of focusing on the destination, we'd do better to enjoy the journey, the work that leads to the raise, rather than the raise itself. In order to enjoy life, you must do enjoyable things. Read nice books, enjoy sports, take time for enjoyment. There's nothing wrong with that. They say part of the problem might be our priorities. The Declaration of Independence describes the pursuit of happiness as an inalienable right, but how many of us pursue it regularly? And if we're not chasing happiness, what are we chasing? So I know some of you listening are asking yourself, why is he talking about happiness on a business podcast? This is supposed to be what nominated the best business podcast, right? Well, haven't you got the message yet? Is there anybody listening that doesn't agree with the message that's been broadcast on this show now for, what, 60 episodes out of the 78? That passive investing is the way to go, and that if you can set it and forget it, you don't need to waste all your time looking over stocks and reading annual reports and all that nonsense. So what do you do with your time? How do you find happiness? Ideally, you'd have enough money to provide shelter, food, and education. Then what do? I know some people are struggling with finding purpose in their lives, and that's why one of the best-selling books is called The Purpose-Driven Life. People have their basic needs covered. Then what do they do with their time? I think it's something worth exploring occasionally on this show, too. And in the meantime, here's a song from the PodSafe Music Network, Mike McGill. Happiness is like a kiss.
When you're down and feeling blue, there are certain things that you can do. So
take your time, you must pursue, 'cause how you choose may define you. Don't get caught up in a great big lie, that life sucks and then you die. Wipe those tears, kiss the blues goodbye, above the clouds is a big blue sky. Don't try so hard to seek it, you will know it when you find it. You must share it to enjoy it. Happiness is like a kiss, so smile at a passerby. Whistle when you want to cry, wipe those tears, kiss the blues goodbye. Remember what I said about the sky. Start your day with a great big smile, you'll see those blues were just a trial. Head out your door now and go in style, you'll find that the life you lead is so worthwhile. Don't try so hard to seek it, you will know it when you find it. You must share it to enjoy it. Happiness is like a kiss.
Oh, there's nothing like a good whistling song. I wish someone needs to put together a compendium of all the songs that have whistling in them. There's more than you might imagine. Yeah. Let's play a round of the world's favorite game. At least the world of Mad Men Machine listeners. Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll the marble, and for the selected guru, I'll give you a little background on their investment philosophy. So here we go. The winner this time on Madman Machine Show 78 is Charles D. Ellis. Charles D. Ellis is the author of the classic investment book called Winning the Loser's Game, published in 1998. The premise of the book is that individual investors can achieve far greater success working with financial markets than against them. In the first chapter of the book, he says, "Unhappily, the basic assumption that most institutional investors can outperform the market is false. Institutions are the market. They cannot, as a group, outperform themselves. In fact, given the cost of active management, fees, commissions, and market impact of transactions and so forth, 75% of investment managers have and will, over the long term, underperform the overall market. Because investing institutions are so numerous and capable and determined to do well for their clients, investment management is not a winner's game. It has become a loser's game. Day trading is worse. It is a sucker's game. Don't do it. Ever," says Ellis. He says, "Consider the profound difference between a winner's game and a loser's game. In a winner's game, the outcome is determined by the correct actions of the winner. In a loser's game, the outcome is determined by mistakes made by the loser." He says, "Dr. Simon Ramo," which I think is the R in TRW, "identify the crucial differences between a winner's game and a loser's game in an excellent book on playing strategy called Extraordinary Tennis for the Ordinary Tennis Player. Over many years, Dr. Raymer observed that tennis is not one game, but two. One played by professionals and a very few gifted amateurs. The other played by all the rest of us. Although players in both games use the same equipment, dress, rules, and scoring, and conform to the same etiquette and customs, they play two very different games. After extensive scientific and statistical analysis, Ramo summed it up this way: professionals win points, amateurs lose points. In expert tennis, the ultimate outcome is determined by the actions of the winner. Professional tennis players stroke the ball hard with laser-like precision through long and often exciting rallies until one player is able to drive the ball just out of reach or force the other player to make an error. Amateur tennis, Ramo found, is almost entirely different. The outcome is determined by the loser. Here's how. Brilliant shots, long and exciting rallies, and seemingly miraculous recoveries are few and far between. Instead, the ball is often hit into the net or out of bounds, and double faults at service are not uncommon. The amateur seldom beats the opponent, but instead beats himself all the time. Another loser's game is golf. Tommy Armour, in his book How to Play Your Best Golf All the Time, says the best way to win is by making fewer bad shots, an observation with which all weekend golfers could concur. Likewise, the money game we call investment management has evolved in recent decades from a winner's game to a loser's game. Basic change has occurred in the investment environment. The market came to be dominated in the 1970s by the very institutions that were striving to win by outperforming the market. In just 40 years, the market activities of the investing institutions shifted from only 10% of total public transactions to an overwhelming 90%. And that shift made all the difference. No longer was the active investment manager competing with cautious custodians or amateurs who were out of touch with the market. Now he or she was competing with other experts in a loser's game where the secret to winning is to lose less than the others lose. And of course, Charles Ellis, in his book, Winning the Loser's Game, goes on to talk about how to do it, and the way to do it is to own the market, buy index funds. And of course, no day trading, because that's a sucker's game. Congratulations, Charles Ellis, you're the guru on Madman Machine Show 78. In the 12-step program for active investors, September brings us to step 9, history. Understand the historical risks and returns of indexes. Long-term data is required to estimate the expected risk and return for different stock market indexes. We now have almost 80 years of monthly risk and return data on several important indexes. This mountain of empirical evidence proves that index funds are the most reliable and logical investment choice. Since you cannot predict the future based on recent events, the study of long-term stock market data is the only source of probability distributions of the expected risk and return of investments. I'd like to bring in now Mark Hebner from his own podcast on the 12 Steps. Mark, in order for our listeners to be reformed, they need to have a strong understanding of the market's past and how it has performed. Is that a fair synopsis of this next step?
Yes, it is. What investors need to do is they need to understand that economics is a social science. It's a combination of news about capitalism and humans' reactions to those news stories. And because the news is varied over time, oil embargoes, wars, all these kinds of events, it's important that you look at very long-term history to see how much risk you're actually taking. For example, if you looked at just a three-year period on your investments, investing looks pretty darn good. You know, maybe you should just, not worry that the market's going to go down. But if you go back to 1973 and 74, you'll see some very dismal returns where over 2 years, even just a safe investment had dramatic drops in the value, 40% over a two-year period. Recently, of course, you could look at your dot-com crash and see even greater events, but that was mostly for those who were speculating in the market, not for an indexer that had a small value kind of tilt. And it's these kinds of comparisons that you'll only know about if you go back and look at long-term historical data.
In your book, you talk about how this long-term historical data can demonstrate the effectiveness of capitalism over most of last century. Can you elaborate on that?
The reason you invest in the market is because capitalism works. And I think the great majority of investors lose sight of this fact that capitalism is why you do this. I often tell investors there's only two reasons you should sell your portfolio or a piece of your portfolio. Number one is that you need the money, and number two is that you've lost your faith in capitalism. The best way for you to build up your faith in capitalism is to look at this long-term data and see that over 80 years, the market earns about 10% per year. And if you were able to capture those returns, there's an enormous growth in your dollar over these periods of time. This is sort of a history of capitalism that we've captured in this step. And we think it helps investors feel more comfortable about their choice once they've gone through this historic data.
So step nine makes us recognize the importance of history. How do our listeners continually integrate this as part of their investment strategy and not just a one-time action?
I would say the main lesson from this historical data that you can integrate into your investments is that over the long term, these are good investments. And what it does is it gets you more focused on the long term than the short term. And I think that's the main lesson that you can take away from this step to help you become a better investor.
Thanks so much, Mark. That wraps it up for step nine in our 12-step series. For more information on sources and materials, check out ifa.com. I sure appreciate you tuning into the Mad Money Machine this week. This is Paul Douglas Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes knowing that active trading is a sucker's game to make a Mad Money Machine. I'll see you next week, and please visit our sponsor's website at ifa.com. Take their risk capacity survey, benchmark your portfolio, and look up the contents of one of their 20 index folios. I'll see you next week on a very, very, very special Mad Money Machine.